Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, top 10 legal battles, the Jay-Z moral rights case. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
This is another episode in our series on some of our favourite music industry legal battles of all time.
It's also another edition recorded in Andy's living room.
Yeah.
So it's nice to bring special editions on the road as well.
Yeah, it's very sunny.
It is.
I mean, we've got the curtains closed, but it is sunny.
It is sunny.
I think that probably brings something to the recording.
Well, let's see.
And as well as being back in my living room, we're also back talking about samples. And well, I suppose it's another copyright one. Although we're not really talking about the copyright law around samples, but the wider issue of moral rights, which we don't really talk about very often.
We do not. I think we did the ins and outs of copyright law around sampling and how long you have to have for the copyright to kick in and the difference between songs and record. We had the whole Kraftwerk special, didn't we? Where we talked about the specifics of what copyright law says or unfortunately doesn't really say about sampling. But yeah, although this is a case where the dispute was over a sample, but the sample was cleared. So there was no conversation about whether or not a license was needed and how long the sample was, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, there was a bit.
Well, okay. The core of the case, this is a moral rights case involving Jay-Z. But before we get Jay-Z involved, maybe...
Say that like he's here.
Sitting in
he
the
court. He did testify.
Andy will quote Jay-Z later and do his very best Jay-Z impression. So that's something for everybody to look forward to. And you'll be able to see whether or not you can tell the difference between when Andy is quoting Jay-Z and Andy is quoting Timbaland. I'm assuming you'll do very different voices.
We'll see.
But before we get into any of that, let's talk about this thing called moral rights.
Yeah, because it's not something we tend to talk about in music.
Because we're a UK podcast, and under UK copyright law, moral rights are a bit useless, and so they don't come up very often. But yeah, moral rights sit in copyright law. And basically, the reason moral rights are important... more important in those countries where they're worth having. But the reason why moral rights are important is we know that in this music industry of ours, we have over here artists recording tracks. Over here, we have songwriters writing songs. But the way the industry is set up, it's very common, not in every country, but in most countries, for the artists and the songwriters to actually assign their copyrights to other entities. So we're going to focus predominantly on the songwriting side this week. So songwriters, who are the default owners of the copyright in any of the lyrics they write, any of the music they compose, they by default own the copyright. So therefore, as the copyright owner, they have all of the control over their music that comes with being the copyright owner. So we've talked about that endlessly on this podcast. As the copyright owner, you can control the copying and the distribution and the rental and the communication and the adaptation, etc., of your song. But it's very common in the music industry for songwriters to transfer ownership of their rights to other entities. And usually on the song side of the business, outside of the US, some elements of the copyright will be transferred to a collecting society, and then other elements of the copyright will be assigned to a music publisher. In America, all the rights will be assigned to a music publisher. And once those deals have been done and the rights have been assigned, the songwriter no longer has the control because they no longer have the copyright. And that's why moral rights are important, because what moral rights are about is, as a songwriter, even when you have assigned your copyright to somebody else, so you are no longer in control of your song because the publisher is in control of the song. Well, all the controls of the copyright now belong to the publisher. They are not your controls. However, you do still have some rights over your work. And those are the moral rights. And copyright law distinguishes between moral rights and economic rights. So economic rights are the controls that you have that you can exploit for profit, and that's great, you make some money. Whereas moral rights, it's about morality. And this is saying it doesn't matter that the songwriter has sold, probably, the rights in their songs, and they're no longer in control of their songs, and because they did that to make some money, there are certain things that they can still restrict in relation to their work, because it's a matter of morality.
As you've already alluded to there, I mean, as with all things copyright, as you move around the world, what moral rights actually protect does change. So you said the UK one's not that helpful. In other places, they are a bit of a stronger right.
Yeah, I think most people would agree that the moral rights are stronger under continental European copyright law, especially French copyright law, remembering that French copyright law sort of starts from a different place than English copyright law, and French and English copyright law are very influential around the world for reasons of history. Because French copyright law, its starting point is, if you write a song, that song is an extension of you as a human being. So the basics of copyright is actually, it's part of human rights. You've written a song, it's an extension of you as a person, so it's just a given that you should have some control over this extension as you as a person. And because that's where French copyright law begins, whereas English copyright law is a little bit more, you put in some effort, you invested some time, you should have this control so you can make some money. Because French copyright law starts from that sort of human rights perspective, moral rights are generally a lot stronger under French copyright law. I mean, for example, moral rights under French copyright law last forever, whereas the economic controls of the copyright in France, like everywhere else, are for a period of time. The moral rights last forever under French copyright law and generally go further in continental Europe. Whereas in the UK, we do have moral rights. There are basically two moral rights under UK copyright law, both of which originate in one of those copyright treaties. Are you a fan of copyright treaties?
Love them.
What's your favourite copyright treaty?
Ooh, I would say the Rome Convention.
Oh, you're going with the Rome Convention.
Love it.
The one that's irrelevant to this conversation.
Yeah.
I prefer Bern.
Oh.
I've never actually been to Rome. Have you been to Rome?
Have I? Yeah.
Whereas I have been to Bern.
I mean, I've been through it in an airport. That's why I was not sure. I think if you actually went to Rome, you'd know. But I've been to Rome Airport.
I think I would probably pick Rome over Bern for a holiday. But I wouldn't pick the Rome Convention over the Bern Convention because the Bern Convention is the one that is relevant here. So the Bern Convention, which is really old. I mean, the Bern Convention was originally signed in 1886. So it's a very old,
that is old
global treaty and therefore doesn't mention sound recordings because sound recordings hadn't been invented when the Bern Convention was written. So that's why the Rome Convention is also important for the music industry because that's where all of the global stuff around sound recordings sits. But the Bern Convention covers literary works, so that would be lyrics and musical works. And in the Bern Convention, you will find a section on moral rights. And this is the main clause. So these are the two moral rights that sit in the Bern Convention and which therefore sit in UK copyright law because the UK is a signatory of the Bern Convention. And the Bern Convention says that independently of the author's economic rights, we have to remember that in copyright law, we call songwriters authors.
Yeah.
This doesn't just apply to book writers and novelists, okay, independently of the author's economic rights and even after the transfer of said rights, because remember, it's very common for songwriters to assign their rights to other people. So independently of the economic rights and even after transfer of said rights, the author shall have the right to claim authorship of the work. So that's moral right number one. The right to attribution is what we usually call that. That's the moral right that the streaming services were breaking for years until they started properly crediting songwriters, which is a relative innovation in the streaming space. Not really a streaming service's fault because they didn't have the information from the labels, but it has to be said, I think we have said this before on Setlist, the fact that the streaming services were not crediting songwriters in their platforms until relatively recently, and even now the data's not perfect, that is in essence breaching that moral right, the right to claim authorship of the work, the right to attribution is a moral right that the streaming sector has generally ignored, although they are now addressing that, so kudos to them. But that's not the moral right we're interested in, because this clause of the Bern Convention continues. Also, the right to object to any distortion, mutilation, or other modification of, or other derogatory action in relation to the said work, which would be prejudicial to the author's, the Bern Convention actually says his, which is not on, but this is a 19th century treaty, so we'll let that go, which would be prejudicial to the author's honour or reputation. So that's the moral rights that sit in the Bern Convention, and if you go to the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988, where UK copyright law comes from, basically they just cut and paste that in. So we have the right to attribution. There are some constraints on that where practical. Obviously, we're not expecting every radio DJ, every time they play a track, to also credit the songwriters as well as the artists.
They should.
Well, maybe they should. But there are some constraints on the right to attribution. And then the right to object to a derogatory treatment of the work. So they've taken from the Bern Convention. They're in UK copyright law. Although, the main reason why they're pretty useless in UK copyright law is under UK law, the moral rights can be waived through contract. So if you're the songwriter, so obviously, as every Setlist listener knows, you composed off Fuji.
Yes.
So let's say that you...
That's my moral right to attribution there.
So let's say that you assigned the rights in our wonderful theme tune to me through contract.
Yeah.
Technically, because of the Bern Convention, your moral rights would go beyond that contract. So you would still have the moral right to attribution and to stop the derogatory treatment of your fiend tune.
You're often derogatory about it.
I'm not sure what I was going to be. But in the contract where you assigned the rights to me, I could put a clause where you waive your moral rights. And pretty much every template music industry contract you will see. Obviously, artists and songwriter lawyers will sometimes try to have this taken out, but most template contracts in the UK music industry will have, I, the undersigned, waive my moral rights. And some people would argue that if this is genuinely a matter of morality, you shouldn't be able to waive those rights.
Yeah.
It's either moral or it's immoral. You shouldn't be allowed to waive it. But you can under UK law, and people frequently do. So that's one of the reasons why moral rights are a bit useless. The last Labour government, do you remember when we had a Labour government?
Yeah, vaguely.
It seems like a lifetime ago. In the late 2000s, the then Labour government announced a review of moral rights, the remit being to look at what happens in continental Europe and whether or not we should adapt some of that here in the UK. Imagine that. That wasn't being forced to harmonise with Europe. That was a British government choosing to consider harmonising with European law. They were heady days in the past. So, yeah, that was what the last Labour government said. They were going to look at moral rights in Europe, see whether or not we should amend moral rights in the UK. But then they lost the election in 2010 and it completely went off the agenda. And no one's mentioned moral rights in this country ever since. But because moral rights are a bit useless in this country, there are very few moral rights cases that come up in court that can inform how these things work. And even less in the music space. The one that's possibly worth mentioning is from 2003.
And that was a record label dispute.
Yeah, that was between Confetti Records and Warner Music. Moral rights was only part of the case. There was various disputes over whether or not a contract had been signed or not, and whether or not a fax constituted a contract or something. So moral rights were kind of a side issue on this case, but it was where a guy who'd created an instrumental and then a record company had that instrumental. They then did a deal with Warner about that instrumental appearing. It was a garage track, basically, appearing on another record. And then the version that got released, they had another group rapping on top of it. So it is kind of similar to what we're going to be talking about in a moment when we get finally to talking about Jay-Z. But the composer, the producer who created the original instrumental as part of this dispute, one of the things he said was, "You have put all of this rap stuff on top of my track."
That is probably how the judge was talking. It's rap stuff.
But the point was that what the composer of the original track was saying was that the lyrics that are being rapped are offensive. Therefore, this is a derogatory treatment of my work. So it was a derogatory treatment case. And therefore, my moral rights have been infringed, which is very much what we're going to be talking about in a moment with regards to Jay-Z. But they didn't succeed on the moral rights point in this case. Basically, what the judge said was that, well, on the final version of the track, the rappers rapped quite fast.
Yeah.
And they basically said, no one can understand what these guys are saying. So they didn't have the crisp delivery of someone like Eminem where you could hear every word. So it was just a load of...
I'm sure it's Eminem that the judge was thinking of.
Well, 2003, you know, big news in 2003. And so the judge was basically saying, no one can understand what they're saying. I think they even slowed the track down to 50% speed in court. And they said, we still can't understand what these people are saying. So even if some of those lyrics are offensive, no one can understand what they're saying. So your reputation hasn't been damaged. And I suppose the crucial precedent that was set in that case was that the judge was saying, remember that last bit of the moral right as defined in the Berne Convention, which was you can object to the derogatory treatment of your work, which would be prejudicial to his honour or reputation. So it was basically saying it's not enough to say that you're offended by the lyrics that have been put on top of your instrumental. You've got to show that those lyrics are sufficiently offensive and widely known and widely recognised to have actually damaged your reputation, and therefore on that grounds the moral rights element of that case was unsuccessful. So as I say, moral rights not very useful here in the UK, don't come up very often, especially the derogatory treatment moral right. They come up even less in America for reasons that we will understand as we now begin the story of the moral rights case involving Jay-Z.
Yeah, so this case ran on for a long time. It relates to a track that Jay-Z released in the year 2000, Big Pimpin', which was produced by T Timbaland. The record includes a sample of a snippet of music by the late Egyptian film composer Balai Hamdi. And the story goes that Timbaland sampled this bit of music in the track. He originally sampled it from a CD of license-free music that he'd got in his studio, so he didn't think there was any issue.
Yeah, I think he thought that because it was quite an old piece of music that it was public domain, it was out of copyright.
He didn't think there was any issue at all. But then EMI Arabia came to his people after the track had been released and said, actually, that is in copyright and we control the licensing of that copyright. Actually, EMI had an agreement with an Egyptian company that in turn had an agreement with the Hamdi estate. And so that deal was done and they thought it was all fine. But then in 2007, the Hamdi family, led by the late composer's nephew, Osama Ahmed Fahmy, said that they still had issues with this. And they sued everyone involved in this track. They sued Jay-Z, Timbaland, all of their, you know, the labels and publishers. They sued Paramount Pictures for using the track in a Jay-Z documentary and MTV for using it on a Jay-Z special. They really went all out and they said various things about why this shouldn't have happened. One was they said that although EMI Arabia did have the right to license the track, they didn't have the right to license it for adaptations, which this was, because obviously it had been sampled and turned into something else.
Yeah, so it's when you sample of all the various different controls of the copyright, samples are exploiting a number of controls of the copyright, the important one being the adaptation control. And I suppose it is not uncommon that sometimes, even when you've assigned the rights or you've licensed the rights to another entity, that some uses of that music may be excluded from the assignment, or there may be a right to consultation or a right to veto in the contract. And so, yeah, they were saying that, yes, you represent that music, but you don't represent it when it comes to samples. So therefore, EMI Arabia didn't have the right to issue the license, was one of the various allegations that were being made.
But obviously what we're interested in on this episode is the moral rights. And that was the key thing that they focused on, saying that they felt that Jay-Z's lyrics were offensive and therefore it infringed the Hamdi family's moral rights on the track because they didn't like his lyrics.
So yes, there's the crucial moral rights element to this case, which became, you know, the most talked about bit in court. So what the family were saying was, on one level, we dispute that EMI Arabia ever had the right to issue a license, therefore actually the sample was unlicensed. But actually, even if it turns out that none of that is true, beyond what was or was not licensed, there's a moral rights element to this because this composer's music was sampled in this hip-hop track. Jay-Z then rapped on top of it. It was quite a sweary rap. So I suppose in similar to the case that we'd had already in the UK, they were saying those lyrics are offensive. They are derogatory. They are damaging the reputation of Balai Hamdi, and his moral rights have been infringed. Bearing in mind that they were in Egypt and under Egyptian copyright law, the moral rights are definitely there. However, they were pursuing this litigation through the American courts because, well, copyright litigation invariably happens through the American courts, possibly because they felt that the US had better jurisdiction over the recording, because obviously it was an American artist, American track released by an American record company. Also, the damages are always better in the American courts, so if you're going to sue, you might as well sue there. But because of that, the question then came up, okay, maybe under Egyptian copyright law, you could sue for an alleged infringement of moral rights. And then the Egyptian courts would have to consider what the UK courts considered, which is a sweary rapper saying something slightly offensive on top of your music, is that a derogatory treatment? And you have to prove that your reputation has actually been damaged, blah, blah, blah. But we had the much bigger question because they were pursuing this through the American courts, which is, what does American copyright law say about moral rights?
Yes, I mean, before it got to court, and it did, Jay-Z and Timbaland's legal reps pointed out that there isn't a moral right for objectionable content under US copyright law, and therefore there was no jurisdiction of the court to consider this case.
Yeah, basically what they were saying was, here in America, we don't understand this thing called moral rights. We don't understand what that's about. Copyright's all about making money. It's all about the economic rights. It's about having control and exploiting those controls for profit. What are you talking about with your moral rights? That all sounds a little bit socialist. But it has to be pointed out, I mentioned the Berne Convention, so one of the big copyright treaties, which was originally done in the 19th century. Now, it has to be said, the US was quite a long-term holdout on the Berne Convention. Mm. There were various things they didn't like about that treaty. So they did not sign it until the 1st of March 1989. So that's a long time.
That is a long time.
A long time after it was originally written, bearing in mind that, you know, the American music industry had been the big, most lucrative music industry for quite some time by that point. However, they had signed the Berne Convention, and in the Berne Convention, it says, as we've already noted, that signatory countries will provide moral rights to authors, the right to attribution, the right to object to derogatory treatment. So technically, you could argue, as indeed the Hamdi family would argue, that moral rights should be enforceable in America, certainly the moral rights of international artists, because the Berne Convention says that those rights exist. But yes, what the Jay-Z side were pointing out was, you go and read your American copyright law and point to us where there's a right to object to derogatory treatment of your work, because we can't find it.
Yes, so Jay-Z and Timbaland people attempted to have the whole case dismissed, but in 2011 an American judge did rule that the case could go forward. And then finally, bear in mind this lawsuit was filed in 2011, in 2015 it actually got to court, and it was quite good. I mean, our caveat in these things is always, oh, it will never get to court. This did get to court, and it was good because Jay-Z and Timbaland both testified.
It was interesting that the judge in 2011 did allow it to proceed, because it did seem like the JC side had a pretty damn good argument. Yes, OK, you could say, but hang on a second, what about the Berne Convention? America has signed it. Even if the moral rights aren't actually in law, you do have a treaty obligation to protect these rights on behalf, particularly international creators. So maybe that's what the judge was thinking in 2011. But I have to say, I was expecting at that stage, it did seem like Jay-Z's side, to be fair, were making an incredibly good point, and that the whole case would be thrown out at that time. But given that we like things to go to court, and we're always a little bit upset when they don't, maybe that judge, even though they probably knew what the outcome was going to be, maybe they just did it for us.
Maybe.
Because they knew that Jay-Z and Timbaland in court would be good value.
Yes, and they were, particularly Jay-Z. I mean, as I remember, Jay-Z basically got up and did a 90-minute stand-up routine. I think he was fairly confident in the outcome and just sort of chatted.
Well, he's an entertainer.
Yes, and he was quite entertaining. He chatted through his life, his career, his music, his successes. He talked for reasons I'm still not sure about his hand in the success of Kanye West. He also suggested to the court that they should be filming what he was saying and putting it on YouTube and monetizing it. Just like, here's a way for the court to make a bit of extra cash on the side.
But making sure he's properly attributed, I'm sure, if you're uploading it to YouTube.
But the key thing at the end of all of that was that he said, as far as he was concerned, the sample had been properly cleared. Everything was fine. There was no issue. And therefore, the court should rule in his favour.
Which I think brings us to the promised Jay-Z quote.
Yes, because, as well as saying that, he also said, until EMI raised the issue of the sample, he wasn't even aware that there was a sample in the track. Because he was saying that Timbaland is famous for not using samples. So he was surprised to learn there was even one in there. But he says it's not really his concern. When they were in the studio, Timbaland presented me with a track. I didn't even think about there being a sample. And then asked why he hadn't checked that everything had been properly cleared. He said, that's not what I do. I make music. And he then went on to say that he does lots of other things too.
But which he does.
He'd been asked by his lawyer why he might not have time to go out checking the paperwork on any samples. And he said, I make music, I'm a rapper, I've got a clothing line, I run a label, a media company called Rock Nation, with a sports agency, music publishing and management, restaurants and nightclub. I think that about covers it. And then his lawyer pointed out that he'd forgotten Tidal.
Which was very newsworthy at the time.
Yes.
Because his acquisition was quite new.
It was. I mean, a lot of those things had happened since this track was made, so I'm not sure it was entirely relevant. But it was a fun thing to happen in the back and forth. It kind of shows their confidence that they were just sort of, him and his lawyer just sort of chit-chatting back and forth rather than, you know, getting on with the point of defending their case.
I suppose had the court decided that there were moral rights to be defended, potentially whether or not the average person would even hear the sample in the mix might have been relevant to the conversation, in that, remember, under the UK case, it was stressed that you have to prove that your reputation has been damaged as a result of the derogatory treatment of your work. And in order for your reputation to be damaged, the average person has got to be able to hear the sample in there to start with. And the fact that Jay-Z couldn't even hear the sample might have been part of that. But that wasn't relevant. In fact, most of what Jay-Z said, as you've already pointed out, wasn't really relevant to the core thing here. Timbaland, in his testimony, I guess most of what he talked about, you've already alluded to, which was the fact that he thought that he was taking this music off a CD of unlicensed stuff that he was allowed to sample without license, and that was sort of it wasn't that he'd deliberately gone out to find this Egyptian guy's music. That was how he'd ended up with that piece in his track.
Yes, he was also quizzed on why he hadn't dug down right into this and worked out whether or not the license was fully watertight and had indeed been done in the first place. So he went through the fact that he'd originally got it off a royalty-free CD, although the Hamdi's lawyer then kind of dug into that, and Timberlane couldn't remember the name of the CD or anything else on it. And then I think they were sort of trying to say, like, oh, you're just saying that. But, I mean, if you've got royalty-free CDs knocking around the studio, you're probably not going to remember which one's which, especially 15 years later. But anyway, he said, as far as he was concerned, when he made the track, it was all fine. There was no issue. And then a year later, EMI reached out to my lawyers, who got in touch with me and said, there's a red flag. And then he'd gone and sorted that all out. Now, what sorting that all out meant was questioned in a similar way. Jay-Z was asked about this. Why didn't you dig right down into it? He replied, legal just told me $100,000 and you're clear. So he said, do that. And that was his involvement in that.
And unfortunately, Setlist did not exist at that time for Timbaland to listen to in order for him to understand that in most countries there's this thing called moral rights. So we can't expect Timbaland to have said, having paid the $100,000, that, hang on a second, what about the moral rights of the composer under Egyptian copyright law? So, yes, lots of chatter about the careers of Jay-Z and Timbaland and the creative process and the specifics around this track. But in some ways, I guess we've said this several times, I mean, Jay-Z went on considerable tangents beyond the topic. But in they were answering the questions that were presented in court. In some ways, all of this was kind of irrelevant because it all came back to the same question which we'd had back in 2011, which is, well, this is now a moral rights case. Are there any moral rights under American copyright law to be defended? There are under Egyptian law, but this is not an Egyptian case. It's an American case. And despite having in 2011 decided that there was definitely a case to be discussed in court here, I mean, ultimately, the court just ruled what Jay-Z's team have been saying from the off, which is, we don't have moral rights under American copyright law. There's not a case to answer.
Yeah, the judge ultimately ruled that the Hamdi family did not have enough standing in the case to pursue their action, and the whole case was dismissed.
Which they could have done in 2011.
Yes.
But had they done so, they would have deprived us of the entertaining turns that we got from Jay-Z and Timbaland in court, and probably therefore we wouldn't have been doing this podcast about it.
Now, the Hamdi family did not agree with that dismissal.
Unsurprisingly.
So they did appeal.
But unsuccessfully.
Yes, the appeals court judges basically upheld everything that the previous judge had said. They disagreed with the Mohamdi family's arguments, saying that they didn't have a moral right to block derogatory treatment, and concluded that it couldn't be enforced in their courtroom.
Yes, there may well be a moral right under Egyptian law, and indeed under most other copyright laws, even the UK, where moral rights are a bit useless, but if you've not waived them, they're there, but not in an American courtroom. I guess what they were ultimately saying was, if you want to pursue this case, go back to Egypt and pursue it there, or maybe in a French court, because obviously it was a global track, but not here. Thus setting the precedent that if you want to protect your moral rights, don't try doing it in the United States of America, even though they did sign the Berne Convention in 1989 when they said that they were going to protect the moral rights of authors across the world. But they don't, so you can't, and that is the conclusion of the big, big pimpin' case.
Yes, so Jay-Z has the moral high ground. That's the news here. But that is all we've got time for on this special edition of Setlist. You can subscribe on your podcast player of choice to receive more special editions and indeed our normal weekly editions, where we wrap up the week's biggest and most interesting music industry news stories. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.